Welcome to this week's Foxcast. I'm Sonny Fox, and today, a very special show, for me anyway, because I have one of my all-time heroes as a guest, the one and only Robert Klein, an actor. He's a Tony Award-winning Broadway actor as well, singer, dancer. He was the first stand-up comedian to do an HBO special, and yes, he did bring his harmonica, which you'll find out in a minute. We start out this interview, of course, doing what we usually do, checking the volume level on Robert's mic.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, all right, went great. Through it. Let me, how does this sound?
Oh, wonderful, you brought along. Are we rolling? All right, great.
Hey, there's the beautiful blonde. Who needs all these ugly guys?
Hey, play a little of that to start things off, would you? Just go ahead.
Ready?
Yeah, go ahead. Okay, all this is editable.
Bop! 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 I can't stop my leg! I can't stop my leg now! That's my theme song.
Who was the inspiration for that?
I was.
No, I mean, what old black blues player?
Oh, wow. I loved them all, from Blind Willie McTell to Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, who I worked with in the Village. Do you know them?
Not personally.
Sonny Terry was the one who really was the first one to suck on that harmonica. Instead of playing a German polka, breathing out, you know. Okay, do the polka. All he did was breathe in, and instead of... He went, then he bent it a little. You know, and he played with Brownie McGee, who was lame and played acoustic guitar, and Sonny was blind. They worked together for 45 years. They hated each other.
Really?
And I was backstage at the Bitter End in Greenwich Village, opening for them. Many years ago, and they're drinking scotch and milk. I've never seen that before or since. And they call each other River. What are you doing, River? I don't know, River. Leave me alone, River. And they're very impatient with one another. And they go, listen, River, I don't know why. What you doing, River? Never mind, River. I'm telling you. I say, excuse me, fellas, why do you call each other River? And Brownie went, because it goes on and on.
And it must help to have some kind of handicap to play the blues, blind.
Yes, there were certain lesser-known people like bronchitis Harold McDougald. I mean, you know, common cold Willie Farnsworth. Mostly the
Sightless
blind.
Sightless McGee, right.
Sightless McGee. Mostly the blind, you know, syphilis Tommy Newsom didn't do that well.
I did see a legless woman playing at the Jazz Preservation Hall in New Orleans. You ever see her?
Well, she probably was diabetic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or you don't need legs for the harmonica. And Toots Thielman only has one lung.
Well, Tony Fields, I mean, only...
She had one leg.
Right.
Yeah, and I noticed the Great Comedy Channel had their top 100 comedians. They didn't even have her in the top 100. Some kids probably 4 years old deciding.
Well, you know, all those shows are based on what clips they got. I mean, you know.
I'm proprietary about that. I don't like it. You pick out people that are good, that's one thing. But, you know, to have Jonathan Winters not in the top 10,
right.
Robert Klein to have 22, I'm sorry I was insulted.
You should be. Yeah. And we're talking to Robert Klein, and I'm Sonny Fox. One of the things I want to make clear, by the way, I've interviewed everybody from David Bowie to Mel Brooks, but I'm a little intimidated because we're in the Bob Edwards studios, and Bob has just got done talking to Robert for an hour about Shakespeare's take on the Jews. And I'm here to say, well, how old were you when you got laid, Bob? You know, so you can say fuck, by
great,
the way. So,
great.
Anyway.
No, it was wonderful. Bob Edwards.
He is a wonderful
absolute
guy.
Classic, and that was a thrill. And now, fuck him. Let's do this. You know.
Well, he's a great listener, which I could learn from. But you did touch
on... Boy, is he a listener. He hardly spoke. I mean, it was a monologue.
You did touch on it during a conversation that the people listening didn't hear about Larry King. And I was so glad that you called Larry because... or called him out or whatever the term is, because that man is, how can he be so famous and do absolutely no research whatsoever?
Yeah, he's it's softball stuff. He's learned to be slick enough so he doesn't get, people in the know he's ignorant in the depth of the issue, but he's glib and he's facile with his, but to me it was hilarious. He holds up my book, that's worth anything, right? I don't care that he didn't read it, but he pretends he did. It was hilarious, and it's clear he never got past the cover, you know. What a read, Robert Klein, the amorous busboy of Decatur Avenue. Why amorous, Bob? Why busboy, Bob? Why the red print here? Why the raised letter?
Why the hardcover?
Why the hardcover? And why is the spine of the book red and the other part's brown? You know, I just, you know, when he has too many of these Tammy Faye Bakers on all the time, these people who are guilty of malfeasance, like Kate O'Kalin, and they get celebrity status, you know.
Right.
I mean, I give, what's her name, Paris Hilton a pass, because every era always has them. Zsa Zsa Gabor. It goes back to the teens and 20s, fan magazines. There's always society girls that are naughty, you know. Right. It happened one night, Claudette Colbert. Except it's a little advanced now since her career started because of a home movie blowjob.
Wow, yeah, she was very good at it, I understand.
Was she, really?
I
refuse to even.
I never have seen it, honestly.
Yeah.
I never have. By the way, the book he's talking about is The Amateur Busboy.
The Amorous. Amorous.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're no amateur. Amorous.
I was an amateur busboy. It was a summer job.
Well, that was in the Catskills, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
I thought you were a lifeguard in the Catskills.
I was. Both. I saved a kid's life. That's a true story.
I know.
There was all college students running in all the jobs in the hotel, a staff of about 45 college students, right? In a small hotel. This kid checks in with very old parents, you know, and he's 8 years old. And right away, he's crayoning the walls. He's sitting on the luggage so they can't carry it. He throws cereal in the dining room. I mean, you know, at that time, they didn't have things like St. Joseph Valium for children, which they still don't, anything, which would have been good for him. Anyway, they gave him some quiet time. You know, they bring him down to the word gets around in the staff that this kid is murder. Watch out at the pool. His parents bring him down and leave him with me. And oh, by the way, he can't swim. We'll be at the Pinochle tournament. And this kid drives me crazy for 4 days. I was a 17-year-old kid. I was well-trained. But the owner had told me, if anyone drowns, you will go to prison for manslaughter. You understand me? You know, I was a kid. I took the responsibility seriously. For 4 days, a kid tortures me in an inner tube. He's in the deep end. I keep on whistling him back. It was a big pool, a hotel pool. Keep on whistling him back. He keeps on going. He can't swim, right? The fourth day, I look up. My heart sinks to my scrotum. I see bubbles and a tube. I dive in. I run to the other end. I dive in like Superman. And sure enough, he's at the bottom. He took half the pool. He wasn't unconscious. As I was trained, I pulled him in. I got the water out of him. And I was a hero. It was one of the high points of my life. Wow, this kid, they saved the life. Robert, the lifeguard, saved his life. Next day, his parents tipped me $5. How did they come up with the figure, Sonny, how did they come up with this figure? I mean, what was the conversation like? I don't know. How much should we give him? How about 50? What, am I Rockefeller? He saved his life. That's his job, right? What, are you supposed to let him down? I don't know. How long have we had the boy? Let's see. Let's divided by 6 or 35. Here you are, young man. $5. You can use that for college. I could have gotten 15 from the staff to let him drown.
That was one of my favorite bits of yours. We're going to cover those albums because, you know, people know you. A lot of them know you just from those three albums. I mean, they're not aware as much as...
actually four.
Well,
the last...
The Rhino album that you're talking about?
The Rhino album in 1990 was Let's Not Make Love. We also did a music video of it. It was a wonderful song. And you can't even find that album. I guess you got to find it on eBay. I hope it'll be re-released at some point. We're having a complete release this coming spring of all the DVDs. Up to now, HBO has the ones we own jointly. There's some I own alone. We're going to have a complete Robert Klein of all the HBO specials because I'm not in the shelves right now, you know.
Well, this thing, Let's Not Make Love, this has got a frightening cast. I'd love to see this. This has Geraldo Rivera, Joan Rivers, Maury Povich, Joe Franklin, Bob Costas, Marv Albert, to name a few. What in the hell kind of a film is this?
Vitas Gerulaitis, who died in a tragic accident. He got poisoned in a gas heater or something in the Hamptons the next year. He was in it, too. Oh, it was great. It was wonderful. It was a sort of age generation song, Let's Not Make Love.
Oh, really?
We got some play on MTV and what's the other? VH1, right. Mostly. And I resented that it kind of didn't get enough of that play because I thought it was a clever album. Anyway, I really have been in the video business. The trouble with comedy albums is you can't see the person.
Right.
Make a face into the microphone. They were great. Child of the 50s stands up beautifully.
Oh, well, let's I'm going to interrupt you for a second because I heard Bob Edwards talking to you earlier about how can you go on HBO, which we'll cover in a few minutes, and do a special and then go out in public. And I've heard a lot of comedians who, when we approach them to record their concerts around the country, that their managers, usually not them, are interested in that subject too. Well, you know, they'll blow the whole wad. You know, that is if they're a comedian that only writes 1 hour with material.
Well, that's what I mean. But, I've written so many hours of material. I'm not going to never do a line anymore because I did it on HBO.
Well, the thing of it is, what I say back to these people is they're quite wrong. When somebody hears you do your material, they want to come see you do that material.
They want, just like old favorites with a musician.
Wait,
but
you go
correct.
See Led Zeppelin, you don't say, well, I heard the album, screw the concert.
That's right. That's exactly right. But still, it's treated somewhat like it's pretty much passing stuff. And it is my obligation for HBO to give them a new show each time. And so it's kept me fresh because it makes me think of new ideas. That's how I developed a big repertoire in the early years at the Improv in starting in the fall of 66. Mm. The audience was fringe show business then. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yes, Richard Pryor would come up. He was beginning to get a little reputation. Lily Tomlin would come up from the Duplex in the Village. Rodney was there. He was became my mentor. You know, I'll tell you, man, you were brilliant. No, he said, I'll tell you, man, I'm a tough cocksucker, and you were brilliant, all right? You got to come here every night for 3 years now and perfect it. You know, that's the way he was. But the audience was, there were a lot of regulars. You know, people like...
It was almost coffee house kind of thing, wasn't it?
Well, they served alcohol, but it was very hip. It was not yet known to the civilians. It was kind of a show business hangout, like Joe Allen's restaurant was for the actors between matinee and evening and after the show.
Right.
It was kind of inside. And so I faced those same faces every night. I just felt I have to keep on improvising and coming up with new ideas to thrill them. It turns out it was the greatest because it made me... I had a bunch of material early. Rodney used to call it backing up the truck. See, I'll tell you, man, you back up the truck, you write more, you know? Like, take your jokes, it's like taking your fucking kids.
Right. Know? So you got the eighth HBO special coming up, but the first one was live.
No.
Wasn't?
No, none of them were live.
Oh, I thought the first one was live.
Nope. But it was, it aired in December of 75, it'll be 30 years.
I'll have you know, by the way.
Since the first one.
I was living in Philadelphia at the time, and I was one of the first people to have that special thing called cable. And I remember when HBO, you recall this, between the movies, they had no production. They had a Steadicam walking around. Remember that?
Yes.
Just with the floating picture.
Sure.
Between down, walking through between swings and making technically minded people go, how do they do that without a track under the camera? And they just had this floating Steadicam and these psychedelic
colors. I remember that. You know, I hadn't thought of that. It was primitive. It was a small business.
I enjoyed those Steadicam shots between the movies.
They had Eastern Pennsylvania, Long Island, and Manhattan.
Right.
It was Time Life, not yet Time Warner. They had 400,000 to 600,000 subscribers. And they had the idea of showing someone in their natural habitat, like me, doing a college concert. They sent the art director around to various colleges I was booked at. They saw Haverford, the beautiful auditorium with busts of old geezers, woody kind of place, and they said, this is it. Bryn Mawr and Haverford were presenting me in a dual concert, and that was the first HBO special. And it's my choice not to do it live because I just want to make sure the production value is everything good. George does it live because Carlin, he writes his shows, and he's so prolific. I mean, he can do this in a year and a half, and it takes me 4 to 5 years.
Right.
I suppose I can improve on that a little, but he makes it like a play. It's all written, and he works it out. He takes it and works it until he knows word for word. A stage manager has his script, just like a play, with the first word and the last word ending. Right. Now, that's perfect, the way of doing it, because he doesn't make it sound like he did it a million times. He does it so brilliantly. I never do the same show twice. I'm a very Second City improvisation kind of guy. I always like opening up set bits, finding new ideas. So I don't know what if I can catch lightning in a bottle. I don't want to do it live. We've caught a lot of lightning in the bottle by taping. We edit it beautifully and seamlessly so it doesn't look schlocky. You know, they give me money, HBO, and they say, give us a show.
Yeah.
Now, Rosie O'Donnell pulled a fast one out of a few years ago. She took big money. She was a big star. And she did the show in a club in Boston. We take a theater. We have a set. We have a top-notch designer, a top-notch director and all that. And I give them a lovely show. In fact, the debate now is whether or not to do it in high definition. Only one, HBO has only done one, actually a private production, Whoopies was done in,
right.
I hear Bruce Springsteen saw himself in high D and panicked. They had to redo the whole thing in film look. You see
really?
Every wrinkle, yeah. You see high D, you notice a blemish on the wall. You might notice it first thing.
Have you ever seen yourself in the high D?
No, I have not.
Well, Bob, that reminds me of one of your more famous bits of how you reacted when you first saw yourself on the big screen. The hair on your ass looks like a tree.
That's right. That's right. It was a love scene.
Now, yeah. What movie? I missed this.
It was called Rivals. It was a small movie.
And you had a nude love scene, Robert Klein?
Well, they asked me. Joan Hackett, the late, she died young. What a great actress. And we had so much fun working together. Here I am kissing her, love scene. Her husband, Richard Mulligan, is behind the camera watching. God, that was unprofessional. I didn't care. I'm tongue down his wife's throat. No. They asked her if they could push the underwear aside so they, like a buttock, it would be easier for camera and everything not to have to worry. And she was very adamant against it, and I thought to myself, she's not hip. I'm hip. This is the 20th century, man. It's just a body, man. You know what I mean? You have a body. I have a body. We all have bodies. Until I realized it would be my ass, 28 feet tall, in a drive-in movie in Des Moines, where a hair becomes a pine tree.
Now, what was the first thing, the first movie you did where you actually saw yourself on the screen?
The first movie, besides in Chicago and I was at Second City, I did an industrial film, How to Sell Shock Absorbers. I forgot what I played in that, a mechanic or something. The first movie I ever did was Landlord. It was a wonderful movie. It was directed by Hal Ashby, who did Harold and Maude later. It starred Bo Bridges, not Jeff Bridges. I thought Bo was going to be a big star. And a few other people. It was a great, great movie. It was a wonderful movie, and you rarely see it. It was about a rich, white, old family wealth. He buys a ghetto apartment building, and he falls in love with a black girl, and it was just a wonderful movie.
Now, when you saw yourself on the screen, was it like when people hear themselves on a tape recorder and they go, that's not my voice? Was it you up there? Is your own image?
I loved it. I thought, it was a mystical thing about films. Now, I enjoy film work. It's not the kick it was. It's like a war without the weapons. You're up at all night shooting in a night thing. It's fun. There's camaraderie. There's hot soup. Plenty of money,
Good catering, right.
Yeah, the money. The movies is a nice thing. See, I'm spoiled by electronic media and all that because you work hard, and you may do it 20 times. Landlord, Hal Ashby was so finicky that I had to eat vichyssoise for 20 takes. I had to pretend I was hungry and eat this creamy soup. I didn't eat vichyssoise again for 20 years. I couldn't go near it, again and again. But still, when you do theater, which people find, and I've been on Broadway 6 times in plays and stuff, people love live theater, but you have to show up 8 times a week. And that's like a legitimate gig, man. I can't do that. I was in a giant musical hit with Lucy Arnaz called They're Playing Our Song. Marvin Hamlisch wrote the music. Carol Bass-Sager wrote the lyrics.
Because on the Fabulous 50s song you did on your album.
I did all the voices in that.
Yeah, duet. I mean, it was a hell of a job.
Do you play music on this show?
No. We play parody songs.
Maybe. Do you have a copy of my album there?
Of course we do. I mean, we're splicing this in between.
I sang doo-wop as a kid in a group called the Teen Tones. We didn't make a record or anything.
That was a true story?
It's a true story, yeah. And we were on Ted Mack Amateur Hour, like an innocent version of American Idol.
Well, let me stop you for a second.
Yeah.
Because I love the stories behind the story. What other names did you contemplate other than Teen Tones?
I don't remember. But we loved the Cadillacs and the Harptones, those early doo-wop groups. We didn't use the word doo-wop then, but that was a lot of the sound, doo-wop, doo-wop. I don't recall. Right. I don't recall, but we went with that. We used to sing on the Marshall Parkway fence in the Bronx in fair weather.
This was a cappella?
A cappella, which was a remarkable little hangout there across the street from the junior high school. Ralph Lauren was there, Calvin Klein, although they weren't friends then, they're not friends now. Penny Marshall, Gary Marshall, a lot of talented people came from that neighborhood.
Wow.
But we idolized, at that time, the rock and roll business was in flux. Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers were flying high. Frankie was flying a little higher than the other ones. Poor Frankie. And we wanted to be like them. I thought that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I looked up to. And it was beginning of rock and roll. I remember Alan Freed on WINS in New York, the first time he ever used the rock and roll name on television. He had a show called The Moondog Show. And Moondog, Alan Freed brought this kind of gospel turned secular lyrics from Cleveland. So you got the Harptones, Sunday Kind of Love, Heartbeats. You're driving me crazy. Bodo. You know, they did Daddy's Home.
Or, right.
You know, that. Anyway, he called the show the Moondog Show. And Moondog was a New York character who was a, I'm not kidding, he would stand in front of the CBS Black Rock, the corporate headquarters on 6th Avenue, beautiful building, in a Viking costume. He was blind. He had a big staff. He was a blind Viking poet. And he had blind Viking poet groupies, girls from Sarah Lawrence and Barnard that adored his work, that would be the gorgeous girls hanging around him. Very esoteric form of groupie. Blind Viking poet groupies. There are very few of them in the United States. And he heard about Alan Freed's show, and he sued him.
Really?
This blind street person dressed as a Viking, got a lawyer with serious enough intent. That was his moniker, you know. And he had to stop using the name. And
he said, won?
Boys and girls, we have a new name for the show. I think he settled, and Freed said, I won't use it anymore. New name for the show, the Rock and Roll Party. I swear to you. And then I think he went into Charlie and Ray, I Love You Madly. Ooh, wow, wow. Ooh, wow. Ooh, wow, wow. Ooh, wow. I love you madly, cause I don't know what to do. Anyway, I'm taking us back to the...
So in other words, you're saying that if it hadn't been for this 50s version of Monty Rock the Third, we would have had Elvis the King of Moondogging?
I don't know if it was moondogging, but rock and roll was his expression. No one has ever seriously challenged that assertion. Wow. That he came up with the idea, the name of it. Although you see it, I see it in a kind of, you know, the black musical numbers they throw into Hollywood movies. The Marx Brothers often did it. And they felt good about it. They were progressives, but a lot of that stuff was rolling eyes with blacks,
right.
Very racist. I hear the name rock and roll. In fact, Reefer Man is a big number in a big broadcast in 1938 with W.C. Fields and Bob Hope's first movie. It's like a variety show. There's an opera singer on it, and this Cab Calloway doing an up-tempo number with his band called Reefer Man.
Reefer Man.
And they looked like they were reefering.
We're talking to Robert Klein. Raised in the Bronx. And by the way, you're only 4 years older than I am, so I can relate. Your albums are, I'll tell you, to this day, my wife Janet, we're sitting watching television. We can be out in the hotel. We could be anywhere. The one person says to the other, I got to go to the bathroom. The other person says, you got to go to the bathroom.
Oh, that's right.
Every single damn time. Got to go to the bathroom. From Mother Knows Best.
Mother Knows Best.
Now, is this character in Mother Knows Best, is it really a true reflection of your mother, or is this just mothers of the 50s? Or...
No, it was. My mother was, I talk about her in the book, Amorous Busboy of Decatur Avenue.
His new book, right.
Which ends when I'm 25, you know, in the early days. My mother was quite a character. She played stride piano with a cigarette hanging from her mouth. Typical Jewish mother. You know, you come home from school, hey, Megan, where are we? Do get with me. Wah, 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 wah. We're being the same. Tattered dress. She sounded like Louis Armstrong. She was talented. She played stride piano. The only time she smoked when she played the piano. My father was hilarious. He was a textile salesman in the Garment Center in New York. My sister wanted to be a teacher when she was 4 years old, became a teacher for 33 years. She was funny. She could sing very well. We were a very musical family, and my father was hilariously funny.
Was one of the reasons your father was funny, did he use that humor, did his sales? I mean,
he certainly did.
Really?
When he saw Arthur Miller's play, Death of a Salesman, he was very moved. At the end in that play, which is one of the greatest American plays ever written, Willie Loman has a very sad end, suicide, and almost no one at his funeral who cared after all those years he put in. My father's funeral was some good jokes led by me and about 150 people that remember his wonderful humor. Now, he never thought about doing it professionally, and it took a lot of courage on my part, I guess, and ultimately his support, grudgingly at first, to go into show business.
Right.
I always encourage parents come to me, oh, my kid wants to be in show business, so give him, let him try. I mean, you
right.
have to prove you have it. If you don't have the talent, don't bother. But then even if you have the talent, you need the tenacity. You need the combination.
So your father's funeral was a celebration.
Well, certainly it was, but a lot of people remembered. Yes, he used it in his sales. He used it in his life. And there were a lot of smiles when I reminded people and allowed them to laugh. They would say, you know, because Benny was hilarious. He was a very funny guy. And what we call improvisation, he did beautifully. It was ad-libbing then, you know.
Speaking of funerals, I know you were at the Aspen Monty Python reunion. And with the
well, I was the host of it for HBO.
Right.
Yeah.
The ashes being spilled.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Graham
Chapman.
Chapman's ashes. John Cleese did a special with me a year or so ago, and he was talking about how he got up there to do the eulogy at Graham's funeral, and as opposed to making complimentary remarks and all that, he just got into what a son of a bitch he was. He was always late, and he just did the total opposite. I believe you were quoted by Eric Idle as being the first man to use the word fuck at a eulogy. And John said, no, I believe Queen Elizabeth did that.
That's a wonderful.
But you are a big fan of John Cleese.
Tremendous. I met him originally in California when I was asked to host a dinner, which he was being honored with the first annual or second annual Jack Oakey Award. Jack Oakey was an old, you know, box office attraction in the 30s in America. He was a kind of funny.
He was a sidekick.
Sidekick or a silly leading man.
Right.
And I said, it's so appropriate that John Cleese is getting this award, because when I think of Jack Oakey, I think John Cleese. In fact, they're almost one. Jack Oakey, John Cleese. John Cleese, Jack Oakey, Jack Oakey. And I have him cracking up as a. And then the next morning, there was an earthquake, a biggie, the last one in L.A. We were all at the Four Seasons Hotel, and he walks in with candlelight at 5:45 in the morning. We're gathered, some of us, down in the restaurant, which has no electricity, you know. And he comes out with a paper under his arm. Well, that was interesting. I said, interesting. You fucking delicate. I was terrified. First of all, you have someone to be with, his wife, Alice Faye, who was a shrink. She's a psychologist from Dallas named Alice Faye, which was the name of a movie star. But,
right.
And it was so hilarious, shrugging off this whole thing. When we were all terrified. It was interesting. It wasn't interesting.
Robert Klein's our guest. So I want to touch on some of these cuts real quick, because I know you've got so much time. For instance, fear is the greatest salesman. The first time I heard that, I understood it completely. But today, that same premise is being sort of used by the government to a great degree.
Well, it's frightening. You know, wasn't that the one, fear is great, was the tires?
Yeah. They grip the road. Right, what would you do if your wife and children were all stuck on the side of the road with this and rain coming down on the pervert?
That's right. There was a scary tire commercial then. Everything is based on security and fear and making you queasy, and maybe you should carry aspirin around with you in case you have a heart attack. And, you know, if your cholesterol is high, you better do this. And that's a huge selling point, you know.
Well, to quote The Simpsons so often, think of the children. I mean, that's the whole rap. I mean, you know, Christ. I mean, when you got the internet available in every bedroom, well, who are they fooling? I mean, our children have seen things you and I didn't see till we were 35.
Also, pornography was a lifesaver for us as kids. When I found this deck of cards in my father's drawer, my life changed, man. Especially that Jack of Diamonds. It was a very acrobatic menage a trois that was everyone's favorite.
Well, I was stuck. I was raised in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I was stuck with a Sears underwear catalog.
No kidding. Gerald Ford's birthplace.
Yep.
I did an HBO special there, Humor in the Presidency, with Chevy Chase and Pat Paulson. And everyone kept on saying, oh, Mr. Klein, welcome to Grand Rapids. How do you like Grand Rapids? I said, it's grand, and I want to get out as rapidly as possible. But it's very nice.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's why they have all the testing up there. It's a very Dutch Reform conservative. If it goes over there, it goes over anywhere. Yeah. But admit, I mean, did you ever go into the Sears and look at the ladies' underwear, the bra ads?
No. There was pictures that were passed around in school starting in the sixth grade. One of the guys
More explicit than that.
One of the guys in school found pictures that his father took of the mother, like a little personal, their own little porn. That was wild.
So his mother was popular and she didn't know it.
That's right. And also individual cards, always black and white. And then I find a whole deck of cards, black and white, from the 30s in my father's drawer, pristine condition. They were so dog-eared and absolutely messed up. And he never said a word. He would have to admit he owned them. You know what I mean? So we went out, and all my friends played solitaire in the bathroom. They took their turns. But the thing is, it affirmed for me things that I only imagined, whether it was oral sex or, you know, right down to fucking. It was proof there because we weren't getting any. And that's why one of my favorite chapters in the book is the rite of passage chapter when we go to Harlem and we heard about a street corner where there were prostitutes and we went and it's a little terrifying, it's very funny and a little touching too. Somewhere there exists this woman to whom I owed a debt of gratitude. She was impersonal, but she was instructive. And the chapter is called Push Like You Mean It. And, you know, after I get a chance and I'm 15 and my friends are waiting outside, first of all, who would go first? The three of us, we're in her little apartment now,
right,
where she works anyway. She doesn't live there. And who's going to go first? She's in the room getting ready. So we're like, all right, let's shoot for it. You know, once, twice, three, shoot. You put out two or one fingers.
Right.
Just on shoot, she peeks her head out the door and she sees us and she laughs. And I felt so humiliated. God damn it, I'll go in. And I go in first. And then I find that instead of being hot, I was terrified, and I couldn't get it up. And, you know, don't you even feel like you're going to come, honey? You know, like one of those. So she was a beautiful young woman, thin like a model.
Sounds like she was black.
Well, she was. All of these women were women of color on that street corner, of various degrees of color. She was a lovely copper color.
This was your first experience?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And it ended in failure?
No. She gave me another chance.
Oh, okay.
She said
she was inspirational.
I brought this condom from home I stole from my father's drawer. I used to count the condoms in my father's drawer to see if my parents did it tonight. They were hot, my parents. Into their 70s, my mother told me they did it.
Really?
Yeah. And you know, she gave me another one, and she put it on. And instead of having to think, I was cheating on the woman in my very first sexual experience. I was thinking of my Marilyn Monroe calendar, of my father's French deck, and I'm trying, you know, with her. And I have a lovely woman under me, and she put her arms around me, and she relaxed me a little, and she starts to kind of whisper in my ear, just come on, baby, you know, something like that. And she smelled of rose water, and I just realized, wait a minute, I have a woman in my arms. And, ooh, I started to get excited. So salaciousness took a back seat in that first experience. It took some patience. And after cheating on her mentally, which was to become a very important technique years later, thinking of one woman while stooping another became a very handy item.
Very handy, right.
And at the end, she was exhausted. She took on the three of us, $5 each. And she said, well, you boys done good, she said. You know, Cherie will be around here. That was her, Cherie. She said, Cherie will be here every Saturday night. You boys come again. You know, you done good. And I thought, it's like, you know, we graduated without a diploma. And so the way the whole thing worked out, despite the terror going from the subway and to the subway and being there in an inappropriate place for three little white boys, and we survived. It was really a very positive in the end, looking at it through the gauze of time, positive. Everything, there was a sort of glow about my childhood that I didn't see when I was in it.
Right. Well, George Carlin said to me that he said, I was born, and it's the same era, I believe, is your age.
He was brought up not far from me.
Right. And he said, we were born, and I agree with him, in the perfect time, because we missed the first war, the World War II. We were too old for Vietnam, or married, or whatever. Mm. We went through the revolution of the 60s. We had all the free sex, pre-AIDS. We're into the incredible electronic revolution of the internet. The world has become as close as your bedroom, where your computer is. Do you agree? I mean, this is...
Yes,
are we lucky or what?
In fact, it's very profound of George. I just wish he could be a little happier. I think he took the loss of Brenda very, very heavy.
It's funny. When we got done with the interview, he called me later, a few days later, and said, would you take the part about her out? Because he was very frank about it all, and he didn't want to talk about it. I said, sure.
You mean about her death?
Yeah, about his feelings about it and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, he's very bitter in many ways. But he's right. I think this is a fantastic time. The only downside of all of it, I'm 63. I think George is, what, 68, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's approximately. And that is that in post-war America, we had as many as 38,000 nuclear devices aimed at us. Maybe now there are 14,000, still enough to obliterate us so many times over. People don't realize that. And we were the first generation to have such a situation where with the flick of someone's button, you could destroy the world. And there's an irony in that the 50s were so boring. They were so dull, Eisenhower 50s. And yet there's this underlying kind of background pastiche of the possible dissolution of the world violently. We used to have drills put outside.
Oh, we could always duck and cover, right.
Duck and cover, right. And you know, that stuff stuck with me. I had a dog tag that could withstand, I remember from Child of 50s, 1,000 degrees centigrade.
Right.
It had my name and religion, Heb, you know. And they actually told us it could withstand 1,000 degrees. It could withstand the nuclear holocaust.
Well, sure. If they find your charred body, they can still tell
who it was. And this stuff, you know, made an impression.
Well, you were 4 years older than me. I went to that. That was just below the cusp. I was wrapped up with Cheerios and Captain Midnight.
Right.
Was oblivious.
And also Grand Rapids was target number 5,612 to the Russians.
Right. My Little Margie, your bit. Not only did we
Does
have...
Does anyone remember My Little
Margie? Oh, of course they do. But I want you to do your impression of her father or boss.
Her father was Charles Farrell.
Right.
My mother said, oh, he's so handsome. He was a silent movie star, but he was one of those cliches. He could not make it in talkies because his voice was high.
Right.
He was like, oh, Maggie. He had that New England, you know, kind of, oh, Maggie. It was an early sitcom. A Gale Storm was clearly on speed. I mean, there's no question about it. Hi, Dad. I'm going to go, Dad. And, you know, and you had Willie Best doing his you know, horrible... hilarious black with the eyes rolling routine.
Right.
Yeah, Miss Margie. I don't know Miss Margie. It was Stephen Fetchett, and he was Willie Best. They both shared that attribute.
Well, this kind of wonderful TV that we grew up. By the way, she went on to the Gale Storm show, remember? She was a cruise director.
She also did a few Hollywood movies. That's correct. Mm-hmm. She was very vivacious. She was funny.
Now, in Grand Rapids, we only had two television channels.
Yeah.
One was WOD NBC, and the other one, Channel 3 from Kalamazoo, actually carried ABC and CBS. They would decide which show to carry.
Yeah,
now, living in the Bronx,
yeah.
You had a much bigger selection.
Well, we had, you know, our usual nine channels or so with a rabbit ears antenna, then antenna on the roofs. Sid Caesar, the great genius. I first saw the Marx Brothers on television. Obviously, their first run movies were before I was born. W.C. Fields. Mm-hmm. My father used to rent Charlie Chaplin movies on 8mm.
Yeah.
8mm, we rent movies. I came from a show business house. My parents saw every Broadway show. My father was funny. When I say show business house, they weren't in show business, but they knew everything about it. My mother knew the movie stars, who was married to who and all that.
Well, they must be very proud. They lived long enough to see your success.
They did. They did. They had wonderful lives. They, retired to South Florida. I have a beef with South Florida. I sent two healthy, vibrant 65-year-old parents to South Florida. 30 years later, they were dead. George Shapiro told me that I got the biggest laugh in Seinfeld's documentary, Comedian, that joke.
I laughed because I came to XM from 21 years doing morning radio in Miami. So I'm totally familiar with the Heaven's Waiting Room down there.
Yeah. You were in Miami all that time.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. King of Miami, as it were. Robert Klein's been our guest. And I just want to end this by saying that you've been an incredible influence on so many people, including yours truly, for just, you have this uncanny ability when you're telling a story, I'm sure you're aware of this, of you not only tell a story articulately, but you play three or four different people. You're constantly going from one voice to another.
I know, Jonathan Winters.
Like, for instance, I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
The bit about doing the national anthem.
Oh, yeah.
Jose Feliciano. I'll kill you and all your family. Signed, unsigned. I mean, your voice goes all different places, portrays
George
all these
people.
George
does that, too. That's what makes him so interesting. It's not just monology. Jonathan Winters was the
Yeah, but you, are, sir, are the, much, in my opinion, much finer craftsman.
Oh, I don't know.
It's far more deliberate and far...
Jonathan
the insight
great
it provides is great.
But, I'm so happy to be still... gone strong, and this 8th HBO special will air in December. It will premiere in December, and then they'll show it, the usual 20 times, and then it'll join the repertoire. But it's my 8th one, and it's going to be a good one.
It's going to be...
I Can't Stop My Leg in Spanish this time, a Latino version. We did a hip-hop last time.
And HBO, a far cry from what it used to be in 1975.
How about 43 million subscribers?
Right.
With their other one, Max.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Robert Klein, my guest this week on the Foxcast. I'm Sonny Fox. I love that conversation. I hope you did too. And next week, another guest. Please tell your friends about the show, and thanks for listening.